Blood and Barrels discuss cases that contain graphic content.
And Mike has a potty mouth.
So does Amy.
Nah.
Listener discretion is advised. What's going on, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Blood and Barrels. I'm Mike.
I'm Amy, and I'm awesome.
You are not only awesome, you're intentionally trying to irritate me,
What?
Confuse me is what I was trying to say. That just came out way wrong.
Wow.
Yeah,
sorry.
No, sorry.
I'm not trying to irritate you.
No, you're not irritating me. You're confusing me.
Totally different words and meanings in those.
Man, that's like, okay, here's what I'm thinking, and here's what came out of my mouth. Yeah, so anyway, sorry.
Love you too, boo.
Oh, you know I love you.
Even when I irritate you, huh?
Even when you irritate me, I still love you.
That's how
love works, right?
I mean, you irritate me all the fucking time, so.
I know, you must love the shit out of me.
I do.
That's all I'm saying. Because
yes.
I'm not easy to live with. Probably not even really easy to get along with, honestly.
You're hard to love. Yeah.
That's why our song.
Yeah.
So.
No, I love you very much.
I love you too. All right. So now that you all know how much we absolutely love each other.
And irritate each other.
Apparently irritate each other. What's going on, boo?
We're still trying to keep ahead for you guys. So.
We are. We're getting things done. Although I feel like the universe is conspiring against us today. But you know what? That is okay.
We're fighting the universe.
We're persevering all the same. We will persevere. So, but that being said, I think we're going to New York this week.
We are going back to New York.
It's our third New York case.
It is, but this time we are in Linden, New York, or Linwood. The brewery's in Linwood. The case is in Linden. They're very close together, I confirmed.
We're in the Lynn area.
Yeah. I confirmed that they're close to each other. So we're checking out Dublin Corners Farm Brewery.
Yeah. I love the, Dublin. It's got a little clover leaf. I'm feeling it.
It's huge.
You know, I get all mushy about the Irish stuff, even though we've established, I think in a recent episode.
That you're not Irish?
Not really Irish, probably.
But the can is huge.
I would totally 23andMe just to find out, but.
Your grandmother already did that.
No, she did not. She did like the Ancestry.com.
Which already said you weren't
shit.
Irish.
Yeah, I need to go back and look at that and actually, I think you read way more than I did.
I read the whole thing.
Did you really?
Yeah, it's like Holy five shit. Pages.
No, it's not.
It's short.
The intro.
It's shorter than the one that's for my family.
That's probably true.
I read yours and never mind. In case my cousin's listening, I'm not going to finish that sentence. So yeah, we're going to Dublin Corners. It looks like they have two locations. Their actual brewery is in Linwood and then they have a tap room in Geneseo?
Geneseo? I don't know. We're probably fucking that way up.
That is the county, though. Apparently, there's a city, and the county is named after it.
All right. So, if we fucked up your county and your city, we apologize.
We'll stick with Linden and Linwood. We can pronounce those.
Yep. I agree. So, coupon. BOGO. Buy one pint, get your second free. Hell yeah. If only we were close enough to use that. So,
anyway.
So I think we're going to start off with the Better Red Than Dead. This is an amber ale, and it's a 5.5% ABV.
It is their flagship brew. It has won awards, and it uses New York State ingredients.
Nice. I do love an amber. I'm a big fan.
I like the name.
Better Red Than Dead? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. It's a good name. All right. Ooh, I'm getting effervescence. I'm pouring it out. We're going to be real head. There's going to be a lot of head. It's a big can. Actually, no, this poured great. This has perfect
head. You just spilled all over the floor.
But again, I put perfect head on that beer. Despite,
every time.
Despite having poured it all over the damn floor.
I'm not sure I want to build a table. You might cover it with beer.
I got it on the floor.
There's only two. I didn't even see that, so you should have just kept
two
your mouth
little
shut.
Drops on the table. It's going to be see fine.
That. All right.
All right. Cheers.
You look confused.
So it's good. Is it just me, or am I picking up like a lot of malt in that?
To me, malt very is malty. Whoppers, so no, I don't taste malt, because I think of chocolate malt.
Yes, but malt is also an ingredient in beer.
I'm aware.
That being said, I think the flavor is good. It's very, like I said, it's probably more malty than most of the amber ales that I've had.
Mm-hmm.
We did have to stop it for just a second, because I was like, what's the difference between a red and an amber? And Amy, we were both looking. So why don't you, if you've got that, what was the difference between the red and the amber?
Well, hold on.
Well, I can pull it up. So I've got it right here. So this says, while ambers and reds are very similar in structure, the major difference is the contribution of caramel or crystal malt.
Mm-hmm.
Ambers use the crystal malt for flavor, or for both flavor and color.
And body.
And body. Reds are lighter and drier and have a toned down caramel flavor. So I would actually say in this case, this is probably maybe a little bit truer of a amber than you get in a lot of cases. It has a very bold caramel malty flavor to it.
Which is why I think it's classified as both, because she actually listed it as an amber ale.
And it says it's an amber ale on the can, yeah.
It does, but then, like on Untappd, it's listed as red ale and American amber, because it's red in color, I think. So I think it's kind of like a crossover between the two, but I would agree it's much more ambery than redhead.
Yeah, for sure. No, it's very good. I think, like, if you like a nice, bold flavor.
It is very bold flavor.
Then I would say this is a great one for you.
All right, what would you give it?
I would give this 4.5.
Okay. Checking. Brewery Pioneer level 18.
Nice. Well, very good. All right, so we've got our beer. We know where we're going. What's our case?
Our case is the Linden Murders.
The Linden Murders. I only know a little bit about this from hearing you talk about it, but I don't know anything about this one.
So it's another old one, but there was a book written about it in 2013 that kind of brought it back to the forefront of people's minds. It's technically unsolved, and I initially was actually going to do one episode about the case and then read the book and do another episode. But had I done that, the first episode wouldn't have been like 25 minutes. So I read the book.
In an evening. This woman reads like a freaking speed demon. It's crazy.
I did. I read the book in one night just to get some more context. So this episode is going to be a little bit different, because I'm going to give you what happened in the case, but I'm going to tell you who the author thinks the murderer was. Technically, the case is still unsolved because everybody involved is dead and they can't prove anything. But the author, Rob Thomas, who wrote the book called The Linden Murders Solved, used today's like profiling standards and FBI guidelines, and like even I think reached out to like John Douglas to go through the list of all the suspects and narrow it down to present who he thinks was responsible for what was possibly a serial killer in the early 1900s in Linden, New York.
That's impressed. I didn't know he would have time to write books while he was fronting for Matchbox 20.
That's Rob Thomas. This is Rob Thompson.
Damn it. So close to a really bad dad joke, and I ruined it.
It was good, but you confused me. I was like, wait, did I say his last name wrong?
Okay, so not Rob Thomas, Rob Thompson.
Rob Thompson, correct. Rob Thompson wrote the book.
It's so bad. My kids are like, you're getting to the dad joke stage of your life. And I'm like, I know, it's terrible.
And hey, guys, I just want to throw this out there. If you hear Trixie, the mascot, really sorry we can't keep her quiet this time.
No, she's got a little eye infection and she's got a cone on her head, so she keeps shaking it and we can't take her collar off. So
yeah,
she's just gonna have to deal with it. Sorry.
And you know, just keep her in your thoughts that she doesn't lose her eyeball. We're doing good so far.
She's good.
We're doing good so far.
I was looking, they thought she was for a minute. Like, she had like a blood. They're like, what happened? I have no idea what happened. So anyway, yeah. She won't lose her eyes. She's fine.
Just ignore the shaky shakes that you hear.
True. So anyway, you ready to hop into this case?
I am. And so what I thought was interesting about Matchbox 20's lead singer, Rob Thompson.
I know. I fucked it up.
Was that he was actually able to like reopen the case files and like really delve in.
So, like, he worked with the police to actually, like, get a hold of some of them. Oh, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, so he's not, I'm not really sure what he does, but it was just something he was interested in and spent time trying to figure out what happened. In the early 1900s, the small town of Linden, New York, saw several murders that, like I said, are still not officially solved today. The murders took place over a 17-year time frame.
17 years? Mm-hmm. Holy shit.
And there were 6 murders in 17 years within an 8-mile radius.
And we believe them all to be connected, I'm assuming?
Yes.
Okay. It's just interesting spacing. 6 over 17 years. Mm-hmm. That's, yeah.
It is very, very interesting. So Linden is about 19 minutes away from the brewery from Dublin Corners, which is in Linwood. And it is also about 40 minutes away from Buffalo, just to kind of give you an idea of where it is. And the only reason we know where Buffalo is because it's pinned on our map.
Yes, we did do a case. We did a case there.
We're not real familiar with New York, but
I know I can't drive there anymore.
Yeah, we've talked about that before too. License revoked.
Only there. I don't have a license there, so they can't revoke it. They tried to get my license revoked here. But they failed because Texas was like, fuck you. We're Texas and we do what we want. Yeah. Can't tell us what to do.
Everybody knows you can't tell Texas what to do. Let's just be real honest.
So true.
So Linden today, there's not a lot left of it. It's kind of a really small town. I think I read in the book there's something like 35 homes in Linden now.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah.
But even in the early 1900s, it still wasn't very big. It was considered a farming town and had only about 100 residents, which makes you think that pretty much everybody knew everybody.
And everybody that's there now is probably descendants of the people who were there before. Yeah.
Exactly. Which makes the first murder that we're about to talk about pretty odd.
Okay.
So the first murder happened on November 12th, 1917. The victim was actually a Jane Doe. She was described as a woman being between 25 and 30 years old. No one in Linden recognized her, but people saw her and said that she was wearing a black coat and was walking with another stranger, a man that nobody recognized, into the woods.
So like transients?
Maybe. We honestly don't know.
Yeah.
But it was said that the man was later seen coming out of the woods without the woman.
Never a good sign.
Exactly. There were a bunch of varying descriptions of this man as far as height, what he was wearing, and like one description, they said that it looked like the man was shorter than the woman. And he was probably foreign, and he was wearing, like, this dark-colored hat. Another witness, though, said that the man was about 5'8 or 5'9, which was much taller than the woman, And his hat was colorful.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's a big difference between...
And there was a lot of discrepancy between the description of the man. The description of the woman was pretty consistent. Like, age was 25 to 30, but what she was wearing, her hat, all that seemed to be pretty consistent. Now, I'm going to throw this out here, and you're not going to know what I'm talking about, but you will in a minute. A man named Frank Hunt, he was about 5'9". So, about the same height as one of the witnesses described the strange man to be. So, now I'm going to tell you who Frank Hunt was.
Oh, I was like, what? That was it?
No, okay. Now I'm going to tell you who Frank Hunt was.
Okay.
He was actually the one who discovered the Jane Doe's body.
Oh, okay.
It was discovered on his land, which was actually not directly in Linden. And it was within that 8-mile radius, but kind of outside of the town a little bit. But he was still part of that. Everybody knows everybody.
He's part of the community. Yeah.
Yeah. He was actually walking around his property, gathering like twigs and sticks to fill up his heater stove. Because, you know, back in the day, that's how you warmed your house.
Hell yeah. You got to stay warm.
Yeah. Especially in New York.
Yeah, right.
And so I guess he like bent down to move some brush that he was going to gather as kindling. And when he did, he saw the woman's face. So she'd been like hidden under some brush, but she had obviously been really badly beaten and her face was still covered in blood. They said they found her about 3 days after. Oh, I said that already. 3 days after she disappeared.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you reset it because I was sitting there going, wait, how long after? So that's good. I'm glad you said that.
One of the interesting things was that the body was found in a 3-foot hole. And according to Rob Thompson, it almost seemed as though it was a pre-dug grave for her. Like it fit her body perfectly.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. They also found in the hole a handkerchief with the initial J on it. So maybe her first name started with a J. And there was no sign of struggle at all. Just she's in the hole with a bloody face. So we're going to go back to Rob Thompson, the author, for a minute. He obviously starts investigating the murders with this murder because it was the first one. And they don't call her a Jane Doe going forward. They call her Ruth. So I'm going to refer...
So they just gave her a name?
Yeah, they just gave her a name. So I'm going to call her Ruth from now on, but Rob Thompson believes that Ruth knew her killer, which would explain that there was no sign of struggle.
Sure, yeah.
Her walking willingly with the man into the woods.
Although I find it odd that she would know her killer if nobody knew who she was, unless she came out of town visiting somebody who lived there.
Right.
Right.
Right, and because they still have not figured out who she truly was, they don't know. But because of the way she was killed and the evidence that they do have, Rob Thompson and even John Douglas believe that she probably knew, it was at least familiar with her killer, right?
Yeah, right. Enough to at least, you know, have a level of trust that, you know, they're not going to murder you.
Right, exactly. And John Douglas actually went on to say that he believed that the signature of this killer was face mutilation, which signature's a little different than MO. It's like what they do to leave their mark, right?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. That makes sense.
So he believed that whoever killed Ruth, his signature was mutilating the face because she had been pretty badly beaten.
Gotcha.
Which I think is part of why they couldn't ever determine who she really was.
But you said that people had seen her like around town previous to this, so...
They saw her walking into the woods. They didn't recognize her, right?
So it could have been that they did know her, but at a distance they didn't...
No, they didn't know her.
They didn't know
and
her,
and then when
okay.
they found the body, they still didn't know her, which is how they made the connection that it was okay. that woman.
And obviously I'm assuming there's no like missing persons from no. the people who live in town. Okay, right. All right.
It had also been so cold that investigators thought that the cold actually acted kind of as a refrigerator to preserve her.
Yeah, that's pretty normal.
Which is probably why you could still see her face, even though it was covered in blood, all of that stuff. Like I said, she was discovered on the Hunt Land, which is about 8 miles from London. After looking at the damage to her face and head, people began to believe that she may have been struck with a hatchet.
Oh, okay.
They didn't have a murder weapon. They didn't have anything like that. Just from what they had, that was the belief.
Did she have like a deep gash in her face or skull that would indicate that? Or was that just what people were saying around town?
We'll get into her official wounds here in a minute.
Okay.
Because she had multiple. But based on the official wounds, that's what people, their best guess was she had been attacked with a hatchet. They did. When she was discovered, she was still completely clothed and she was face up. Like I said, she was beaten so badly they couldn't tell who she was. They even said she didn't really even look human.
Oh, wow.
Because she was beaten so badly. So obviously they never identified her, hence she is called Ruth. So her official wounds were a cut on the right side of her jaw, a 4-inch cut on her right leg above her knee, a small cut on the right side of her waist, then her frontal, like, forehead bone and nasal bones were crushed, and there was a fracture at the base of her skull.
So maybe like the blunt side of a hatchet?
Yeah.
I mean, I will say the placement of the wounds seems somewhat random. Like face, back of the head, leg, side. Like
But it's all on the right side too.
So left-handed killer?
Maybe.
Unless they were from behind?
Yeah, maybe. But it's her right leg, her right jaw, the right side of her waist. They found a total of between 9 and 12 cuts in addition to all the blows.
Sounds like a lefty. I don't know.
And then there were no signs of rape, and that is important. So, of course, the tiny town was shocked. Nothing like this really ever happened in London, so they're shocked.
Yeah, right, 100 people. Everybody knows everybody.
But because they didn't know her, they kind of moved on with their lives. Like, you know what I mean?
It
makes sense.
It's kind of a terrible part of the human condition, but when you're not connected to that person we talked about it, I think, in a recent episode. Like, if it doesn't really affect your community, you know, they probably thought, oh, and especially with the first description, if it was some random foreign dude with some random chick, he probably moved on. Community's right. Safe, and who gives a shit?
Well, and I think that's exactly what they thought, because the next murder did not happen until 5 years later.
That's a huge gap. Mm-hmm. That's a huge gap.
So the second murder happened on October 17th, 1922. But this time, the victim was really well known to all of the townspeople.
Okay.
They knew who she was. Her name was Frances Lenora Kimball, and she was 73 years old. She was known by almost everyone in town, and she was really well known for her prohibition beliefs.
Like stopping the sale of alcohol?
Yes, or like, she was. So this is 1922.
That's probably why she got killed.
Prohibition, that is some, there is some possibility behind that statement.
Don't be taking people's alcohol, they get pissy.
Prohibition had gone into effect in 1919. So this was 1922? Yeah, 1922. So prohibition is still in effect at this point, and she was pro-prohibition.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'll get into it a little bit further on, but she had a lot of family members who were alcoholics, so I think that's why she was pro-prohibition. But there was somebody, don't know who, who was known to continue making alcohol available to the residents in London, even though prohibition. So possibility was that there's some prohibition shit's happening in the town, right?
Absolutely.
Now, Frances was known to be really hardworking. She was also pretty religious. She actually owned 60 acres that, if I remember correctly, her father had left to her. And she sold eggs, milk, and apples from her home. Even though she was known to be hardworking and she was known to be friendly, it was pretty well known that even though she was friendly to almost everyone, she was only close with very few people. Which...
Well, that's fair.
Yeah.
Especially, she's a member of the community. She engages with everyone, but she has those that very like core group.
Right.
That she... And she, I mean, she's a little bit older, right?
She's 73.
So
her best friend's name was Grace. And we'll talk about Grace in a little bit. Frances lived with her brother. And again, I'm going off of memory here, but I believe her brother was a twin. And they were kind of both alcoholics. And like I said earlier, her dad left her the land. Apparently, he did not leave the twins anything. Something happened in the...
That sounds like motive.
Yeah, just saying. Something... Well, exactly. And her brother that lived with her does become a suspect at some point. But it was really well known that the Kimball family was really dysfunctional. And I'm pretty sure, my own opinion, these twins were a little jealous because they were the bullies. But dad left all this acreage and farm to his daughter and not the boys, and they were left out of
it leads me to believe, based on the time frame, that they were kind of fuck ups. Mm-hmm. If he, you know, because that was very odd for that time. Yes, yeah,
absolutely. Now, Frances, like I said, she did let William come live with her. I'm not exactly sure what the other twin was doing, but William was living with Frances. And as I mentioned, it was highly possible that he was an alcoholic. So she was probably dealing with that, hence her being pro-prohibition. The morning Frances was discovered, her neighbor went to her home about 8 a.m., I guess just to check on her, but when he got there, the door was locked, which was a little odd. He said he knocked on the door and got no answer, so like he went back home and waited about an hour and got the same result. When he got no answer the second time, he kind of started walking around Frances's land and realized that her cow hadn't been milked. And everybody knew that Frances got up every morning like clockwork and milked her cow at 6 a.m. So at this point, it's 9 a.m. The cow hasn't been milked. He becomes concerned because this town is known for their ritual and not ritual, routine. They follow a routine, and Frances was known to be a creature of habit. So it was a really big concern if 3 hours after she was supposed to have milked her cow, the cow hadn't been milked.
Yeah, no, I totally get that.
So he called Grace because Grace had a key to Frances's house. And they went over and searched the house, but no one could find Frances. So they called the local magistrate, which I guess they didn't have. It's such a tiny town. I guess they didn't have, like, police.
So, like, the magistrate, to me, that sounds like a judge almost.
Yeah, kind of. But they called him. He came and searched. Couldn't locate Frances. But he noticed that her telephone wires had been cut.
Oh.
And he kind of had that same reaction, so he called the state police. State police show up at Frances's home. They still don't find her. Eventually, they decided to search Frances's cellar, and that's when she was found. Her body was discovered in a dark corner of the cellar under a shelf, and like this door had been put over her to kind of attempt to hide her body. She, like the Jane Doe, Ruth, had been severely beaten. So M.O. is pretty
similar. Signature.
No, this is M.O. We're not talking about signature.
You said the face beating thing was a signature, not the MO.
The face beating thing, the face mutilation.
Ah, okay.
Is a signature. All I said right now is she'd been badly beaten.
Oh, okay. All right. Gotcha.
Now, her injuries, 20 blows to the right side of her head.
Damn.
But it's the right side again. Remember?
Mm-hmm. Yep, yep.
A 1-inch cut on the second finger of her right hand. Bruising found on her knees. They think maybe when she was attacked, she fell.
That's where the bruising came from.
Mm-hmm. She had a broken nose.
Also makes sense.
A broken right cheekbone. And small stone pieces had to be removed from both her skull and her brain. It was pretty obvious that the blow to her head had killed her because when they found her, her brain matter was kind of everywhere.
Oh, shit. Yeah.
Now, initially, they checked for signs of rape and there was no evidence of that at first, but this is 1922.
Right.
So they do some more testing and this was discredited when semen was found on Francis's clothing. So somebody decided to rape a 73-year-old, which is...
That's fucked up.
Yeah.
That's way fucked up. Yeah. I didn't even know they could test for that back in 22. I didn't know they could test for
that. I didn't either. And
unless they just found a... Sorry, not to be crude, but maybe they just found a crusty spot. I don't know.
But they... Whatever they did, they determined that their initial thought was wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, you ready to pause and try this next beer?
Sure.
Okay, so this time we're going to be doing the York Pale Ale, also known as YPA. It is a classic pale ale that is balanced and an easy drinker. It is 5.6 ABV. It's definitely more beer colored. It smells like a pale ale.
All right. Well, let's give it a try.
Cheers, boo.
Cheers. That is way more up my alley. I like that a lot, actually.
That's really good.
It's crisp. It's mm-hmm. hoppy, but it's not like overly hopped. It's very smooth.
Not overly hopped. I like it.
Yeah, it's maybe a little citrusy, but it's not like overkill. It's very well balanced. I love this one.
I was about to say, I would not even call it too citrusy. I think it's a perfect, like you said, balance.
It's very...
I don't know a better way to describe it.
Yeah.
I think it's good for people who like pale ales and people who don't, because I don't normally like them, and I like this.
Yeah, it's a really good pale ale. I love this one a lot. So, I'd five that one? I would, yeah.
Okay. Check in. No badges.
No badges for you.
No badges for me.
Yeah, that's okay. That's really good. I like that one a lot.
It's very, very good.
Yep. All right. So where were we?
So we're going back to Francis. Obviously, it was really easy to determine that she had been killed by the blow to her head. Like I said, her brains were like spilling out everywhere. So
yeah.
It didn't take a lot of investigating to figure that out. And they believe that this is where her broken cheekbones came from, too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah. Like when you said the nose and the cheekbone, I'm like, that all tracks with behind. Yeah.
Yeah.
She was beaten severely.
Now, what's crazy about her case is that the murder weapon was left right next to her body, but it didn't matter because it was stone. Back then, they couldn't actually fingerprint it. So they knew what killed her, but because of the materials, they couldn't...
Was it like a stone from the ground or like a brick or...
You know, they didn't specify. I just got the impression that it was a stone that was in her cellar. But because of the material, they couldn't pull any fingerprints off of it to figure out who had...
So they believe that she was killed in the cellar?
I believe so, yes.
See, that's interesting, because, like, I can't imagine. Now, granted, we don't, here in Texas, because of the clay, we don't have basements or cellars or anything like that, well, at least not most of the time.
There's a difference between a basement and a cellar, though, too.
Well, and that is true. But I can't imagine why you would just take people down into your cellar. Now, granted, I don't live in 1922, so, you know, well, maybe again, she was showing him some radishes. I don't know.
Well, but again, if she knew her killer.
Well, she would have. I mean, I can't imagine her taking a stranger down there.
So, police then continued to search her home. Again, they found no clues. They didn't really have any suspects at first, but they were able to determine that it wasn't a robbery because no money or valuables were taken from her house. Police that were first on the scene would later say that they had seen tire tracks and footprints when they arrived. But it's important to remember that multiple people had searched for Frances before the police were called. And the ground was wet, so it's highly likely that the footprints they saw were from the neighbor or from Grace or from somebody trying to figure out where Frances was.
Well, and let's be honest. I mean, it's 1922. Mm-hmm. How many different types of vehicles are there? I mean, they're all going to use the same kind of tire. Right. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, yes, I know now we realize that tires can be like fingerprints because of the wear patterns and blah, blah, blah. But, I mean, was it really that helpful back then?
No.
Yeah.
And police pretty quickly determined that it was probably likely that these prints were not the suspects. They were somebody who was just looking for Frances.
Yeah.
I said earlier that Frances's family, the Kimballs, was kind of considered dysfunctional. That's important to keep in mind because some of the people they thought might be suspects were related to her ish. Like there was a cousin or something that was married to a dude that might have killed Frances because Frances might have convinced the girl to leave the dude. Like there was all this dysfunctionalness. Her brother was an alcoholic.
So there's no shortage of suspects in this particular murder, basically.
Yeah. Right. There was just no clues, so they couldn't narrow it down to a official suspect, which is why they say there were no suspects. But initially, a man named Andrew Michael was considered to be a viable suspect because he did actually do some work for Frances, but he claimed that he didn't have any issues with her at all, and that it had been about 2 years since he had done any work for her. Now, it can be confirmed that Frances had been seen the night before about 5:30 p.m. Some men rode by her farm and saw that she was feeding apples to her cows. So because of this sighting, police determined that Frances was probably killed somewhere between 5:30 and 6:30 p.m. Again, it's 1922. I think they're just, you know,
throwing out times. Yeah,
they don't have anything.
She was alive here, so it had to happen. Yeah, I mean,
she was alive here, found dead here. So
when was she found dead?
She wasn't found until the next morning, but
I mean,
again, they're in 1922. They're guessing.
Yeah,
right. The FBI has thrown their two cents in to Frances's murder, and they believe that the signature in this case was overkill, which you could say. So John Douglas said the signature in Ruth's case was brutalizing the face.
Yeah,
but you could argue that overkill could fall into that, like that could be the same, right? So they're seeing some similarities. I mean, obviously they were killed the same way.
Well, and it wouldn't be completely outside of the realm of being, I guess, normal that that a suspect would escalate their behavior as they go on. So, you know, it's been 5 years. Mm-hmm. Maybe they've been thinking about it for so long that they went a little overboard, yeah. You know?
Exactly. The FBI also believes that she was so badly beaten because her killer knew her and was angry at her for some reason. And like I said earlier, they knew this wasn't a robbery or a burglary. So it almost had to have been something personal.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So some other suggested suspects were Harry Voltz, who was also an alcoholic. He's the one I was just talking about that was like extended family and his wife had left him supposedly because of something that Frances had said. So his motive would have been to regain his good name.
Okay.
Her brother, William Kimball, was a suspect because it was known that the two argued a lot. He was also an alcoholic, but Rob Thompson points out there may have been a motive there, but would he have raped his own sister?
Oh, good point. Yeah. Good point.
So Rob did give some statistics on the rape of elderly women, and he said that even now, 56% of rapists live within six blocks of their victims. And this is like elderly victims. 30% of rapists live on the same block as their elderly victim.
Not that there's any blocks at this point, but to your point, it would have had to have been pretty nearby.
Basically, it means that based on these stats, the killer was most likely from London, not some random foreign stranger.
Yeah.
And he probably knew Francis.
And potentially could have lived, like, you know, within a very close radius of her home, I would imagine.
Yeah, exactly. So that's kind of where Thompson is basing how he's going to figure out who committed the murders. Now, remember, Francis died in October of 1922. The next murders didn't happen until 2 years later, on March 11th of 1924. This time there were three victims. Mabel Morse, who was 50 years old, actually ran the Linden General Store, and she had left the store to go over to the Whaley home, which is about 50 yards from the store. She went there to get some milk and some of her, I'm assuming some of her employees, but male employees became worried when she didn't come right back because the house was so close.
Well, and it's their store. She's probably helping run it and all that. Yeah. Yeah.
So they went over to the Whaley home to check things out to see what was going on. Also, side note, Mabel was also a known supporter of Prohibition. So there's a tie there as well. When they got to the Whaley home, again, the door was locked and there was smoke coming out from underneath the door. The men were pretty quickly able to determine that there were three bodies in a pile on the floor covered with a rug that they found out later had been drenched in kerosene. Tom Whaley had been an employee of the Erie Railroad. He was shot in the neck and his wife was shot in the head. So a little different, right? But Mrs. Morse, the one who went over to the home to get the milk, had been beaten to death. The weapon used was a clubbed handle. Obviously, the three victims were burned, but they were not burned so badly that they weren't unrecognizable. Everybody knew who they were. And it was determined that the couple was shot with a .32 caliber gun. At the time, it was believed that the fires were started to cover up the evidence of the murders.
Makes sense, yeah.
This time, the police decided they were going to offer a reward to try to figure out who the fuck did this.
Yeah, this is quite a few murders in a very, very small town. They're probably starting to get concerned, yeah. I would imagine.
Yeah. But the reward did no good. There were several people of interest, but no one was ever charged. One of the rumors that kind of floated around the little town was that Tom Whaley knew who had murdered Mrs. Kimball and had been keeping quiet, but then changed his mind and was going to turn whoever it was in. So people believe that he was murdered to keep his silence, which sounds like it would be just a rumor, right? But after Tom and Hattie, that was Mrs. Whaley, after they died, Hattie's sister came forward and said that Hattie had told her that she knew who murdered Francis, but was too afraid to say anything.
Interesting. Okay.
So it's a valid possibility that maybe they did know who it was and they had kept quiet trying to protect themselves, but then the guilt ate away at them and they were going to turn whoever it was in. And they got killed first.
Yeah. See, and that all makes sense to me, but here's, I guess, where I'm a little lost. So they live at the house. the lady, Mabel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. She works at the store, so she's going across. So, I mean, I could get that maybe somebody went there to kill them. And I don't know, but like, but she wasn't supposed to be there. So maybe they were taking them out and then she showed up and they were like, ooh, opportunity to do what I like to do and beat the hell out of this lady and kill her. Like what? Cause she wasn't even supposed to be there.
That's kind of what investigators came to believe, which I believe I say a little bit later, but she wasn't supposed to be there. She was going, she actually owned the store, so she was going to get, I guess, milk. I guess they provided the milk for the store that she sold, but she was going, she was really supposed to be gone like 5 minutes.
Well, right. So I guess why this one's a little confusing is like, so normally, if you didn't have any other, like if you just walked onto this and it was the first crime scene you'd seen, she would look like she was the target.
Absolutely.
It would look like she was the target of the attack, but based on this theory, they went there, or whoever went there to stop these other, from talking and putting out information that they didn't want out there. So really in this one, they went, achieved their goal, but then were able to have a third victim.
Correct.
Who was a victim of opportunity that just happened to walk in.
Correct.
That's weird.
And like you said, though, it's just a theory.
Right. But I mean, it makes sense because they wouldn't go there looking for her.
No, because it wasn't her home. She was supposed to be at the store.
And I imagine she doesn't show up at the same time to go get milk every day. You're like, it was just a random happening. But again, she still wound up being the target. So whoever went there for a purpose, but targeted her either after the fact or during the fact.
Exactly.
But you said that the store was super, super close, right?
Yeah, it's like 50 yards away or something.
And nobody heard gunshots?
No.
Because they were both shot, what, once?
Once each, yes.
Once each.
Him in the head and her in the, or him in the neck and her in the head, I believe.
That's crazy.
It is. And what's even crazier is that the one odd similarity that the police could actually find between Francis's murder and this murder was that both doors had been locked. Remember I said Francis's door was locked?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So was the Whaley's home.
Okay.
The doors were locked. The police never located the keys. They don't. Because they believe that whoever killed them locked the door.
Trophies.
And left.
Key right? Trophies.
Now, police believe that Tom and Hattie Whaley were murdered between 5:30 and 6 p.m. Again, I don't know how they get their time frames, but...
Well, I imagine with this one, it's a lot easier because the lady showed up. Like, they know when she left.
That's true.
So I'm sure there's a much shorter time frame here, whereas the other one, it was much bigger.
Yeah, so they believe that the couple was murdered between 5:30 and 6 p.m. and that Mabel, like we said, walked in the middle of it. And so she was probably killed between 6 and 6:40. Now, they did have some suspects in this triple murder. Gideon Kittle was a suspect because he openly admitted to having a .32 caliber gun. Andrew Michael, again, was a suspect. Remember, he was a suspect in Francis's case as well. But this was also because he had a .32 caliber gun. But apparently, that was not a rare type of gun to have in that area at that time.
No, I wouldn't think so.
So,
I mean, back then, lots of people owned guns. I mean, lots of people still own guns now, but, you know.
Well, true, but like, I'm not a gun person. Like, .32 caliber to me sounded weird.
Well, but like in a small town, there's probably one store that sells guns, and they probably carry like a few models. And
that's true.
So everybody's probably got the same damn gun.
That's true.
I mean, I could be wrong, but you know.
I mean, that is true, but that they had more suspects with this one because of the shootings. But probably for exactly what you just said, they couldn't very well say that Gideon or Andrew or John Smith did it, because apparently everybody had that type of gun. So,
and obviously they didn't have ballistics back then. So what are you going to do?
So now there was a final murder just outside of Linden that some people include in the Linden murders and some don't. It was a murder of Benjamin Phillips, who was a one-armed farmer.
It wasn't me. It was the one-armed man.
The one-armed farmer.
The one-armed farmer.
Like all of the other murders, he had been beaten to death and his body was set on fire. Now, obviously not all of the other bodies were set on fire, but that's the link there with Benjamin. He was beaten to death and set on fire with kerosene.
Yeah, I mean, possible that it was this, that it was the same suspect, but it doesn't sound like it fits the MO.
It could be a coincidence. Anything.
Yeah.
The crime scenes were similar because, again, no clues were left. And again, his door was locked as well, and the police didn't ever find the keys. His son is actually the one that discovered him. And he lived in Attica, which again was only, it was still within that 8 mile radius, but it was not a part of Linden.
Is that where the prison is?
Yes, question mark.
I don't know. I've got, this case is giving me so many movie quotes right now. Telling you. I got Dog Day Afternoon playing in my head. But yeah, I think there was a, I would actually love to do that case.
I mean, Attica sounds familiar. I don't know. I'm not from New York.
So the Attica Correctional Facility is a maximum security campus, New York State prison in the town of Attica, New York. So yes, it is.
I wonder when it opened.
It was probably after this. I don't know what year it opened, but oh, no, opened 1931.
So yeah, after. Right after. Yeah, right after. So again, there were many people that might have been suspects. You know, there was a lot of speculation. There was a lot of gossip, I'm sure. But nobody was ever officially linked to the crimes. And to make the police's job even harder, there was a mental patient named John Vitosky who admitted to the murders even though he didn't commit them. When John admitted to the murders, the town, of course, was very excited. They were like, finally, this shit's going to be put to rest.
Oh, and they're thinking they got somebody for all of it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, because he admitted to all of them. However, he didn't match the description of the strange man that took Ruth out into the woods. But again, maybe Ruth wasn't connected, so let's keep looking, right? But it was pretty quickly determined that he wasn't the murderer because he was in jail when Frances was killed.
Mm-hmm.
So he couldn't have killed her. And he very quickly recanted his story after he said that he did it.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
The town got excited.
For nothing. No, yeah.
Now, there were multiple similarities between all of the cases. No sign of forced entry in any of them. In a couple of them, there was presence of rape after the death, because I believe Mabel was also raped.
Okay.
In none of them was there missing money. Every crime scene had some sort of blunt force trauma. Even though the Whaleys were shot, we still had Mabel, who was killed with
blunt force trauma. Yep.
All of them seemed to have overkill. And it was believed that the suspect tried to dehumanize the victims. That's probably why he beat them so severely, to make it easier to kill them, because then he wouldn't see them as human. So now I'm going to tell you Rob Thompson's kind of like what he did to figure out who he thought actually committed these murders.
So this is the author's theory and not necessarily an actual like real anything. It's just his thoughts.
Okay. This is after he had all of the case notes opened for him. He used modern day psychology and science and things. So it has not been officially proven that he is right, but he believes that he is.
So here's a theory.
Yes. So he actually started out with a very large list of suspects. I think it was something like 20 or 30.
Yeah, that's a lot. Yeah.
Yeah, he went through the town. And
that's like half the town.
Yeah. Well,
a quarter of the town. No, I'm sorry. Yeah. Yeah, about a quarter or a fifth of the town. Yeah.
Well, it's the whole town now because there's like 35 people now.
Well, so. At the time they had, 100? So it was like a fifth of the town at the time, which honestly, if you take all the females, because we're probably not, your perpetrator's probably not female, so.
Not in this case, no.
So yeah, it's a large chunk of the male population in the town.
And so he did, and he looked into each one of them. And he very quickly narrowed the list from 20 or 30 to 5. We talked about Harry Voltz earlier.
Yep.
He was the estranged family member or whatever. Andrew Michael has been a suspect in Francis, and like his name has come up multiple times.
And he was who again?
He worked on Francis's land.
Oh, he was that guy. Yeah.
Gideon Kittle Jr. was also in that list. He was the one that admitted to having the .32 caliber weapon. And then Lyle Chaddick and Myron Smith, who we haven't talked about, because if I literally gave you all the details about everybody, we'd be here forever. But those were his five. Okay, these might be the guy. So after he narrowed it down to the five, he then went back and looked at specific information about the suspect, taking in profiling techniques from John Douglas and what we use now. And what he got was that the murders were used to regain some sort of control. The suspect was probably between 30 and 44 years old. Obviously, he was a liar.
A liar? Where'd that come from?
I don't know.
I'm not saying he's not, but you said obviously he was a liar.
I was being facetious.
Oh. I was sitting there like, I mean, I get that, but where the hell did that come from? Okay, sorry.
apparently, he blamed everyone for everything but himself. He would have been considered cunning. He worked in some sort of trade, so, you know.
Because he was strong or because that's what there was to do back then?
Both. I mean,
they didn't have corporate jobs. And
right.
we're in a town. Well, I guess you're either a trade worker or you're a farmer in this town.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. So he did have a history of petty crimes. And what Rob Thompson said was that his MO, not signature, but his MO was a blitz attack. Which I think that's how you include the gunshots into the beatings, right? He's just attacking however he can attack.
Yeah, makes sense.
So after he looked at this information, Rob Thompson then reduced the list again from 5 to 3. And this time he's got Harry Voltz again. Same disgruntled family member. Andrew Michael is still on there. And Gideon Kittle Jr. still on there. So we're down to 3. Now, I said this early on. Rob believes that he knows who committed these murders. And he believes that Andrew Michael was the Linden murderer. It's known that Michael was kind of manipulative, probably a psychopath. He was 41 at the time of the murders, so he fits into that age range that they give. The Michael family was pretty well respected in Linden, even though they were German, which, think about it, this is right around the time of World War One. So
I didn't think about that. I was sitting there going, what's wrong with the German? Yeah, okay, that makes sense, yeah.
Andrew had been born in 1883. He had a history of theft, like he stole some money, he stole a saw. There was question that maybe he burned down his own cider mill. So he had a lot.
Fits with the other two arsons. Well, they weren't really arsons, but setting the fires in the other two cases, yeah.
He also had a lawsuit with the one-armed man, Benjamin. because I guess Benjamin worked for him and may have lost his arm while working for him. Oh. So there's connection there. And then, like we said a minute ago, there was rumor that he might have burnt down his own cider mill. So he was
Looks like he fits. Yeah,
yeah, he fits pretty good. And it's known that Francis had troubles with Andrew. Multiple people confirmed this, including her best friend, Grace, one of her family members, Emma, and even Gideon Kittle, who was also a suspect.
Yeah.
They all confirmed that she had issues with him. And I think for me, anyway, the fact that he became a suspect separately in both cases before they linked him makes him a...
at least a viable candidate, if nothing else, yeah.
And like I said, this is Rob Thompson's belief, and I go read the book. It's fascinating because he walks you through it, how he gets to that conclusion. And he may be wrong, but he's got a good, at least a good argument for why he believes he solved the over 100-year-old Linden murders.
Fair enough, fair enough.
So, I mean, good for him.
Yeah, definitely.
That's it?
Oh, man.
Although, I will say, you said, side note, motherfucker.
Oh. I was helping her take notes from the book. She was just like, write this down. And I was just, but I got drunk and I started adding shit.
You did, because you said, oh, I didn't think about the German thing, but you did. Because in parentheses, you put, because he was German, it obviously meant he was a Nazi scum.
Well, I mean, that's probably what they were thinking back then, you know?
Not for World War I. Nazis didn't come to World War II.
That's back when they had the Kaiser, yeah.
He did, though. He helped me a lot with this one.
I'm trying to be more involved. I'm trying.
And I laughed the whole time I was incorporating notes. See how the font is different here? I was like, I can't even try to... Hey,
as long as you enjoyed it and had a fun with it, then I'm cool with it. So
I thought it was a very interesting case. You know, I used to not like to do the older cases, but sometimes there's...
We've actually had some good luck with some of the older ones, but I'm with you. Yeah, at the beginning, I was like, I don't want to do that. It's old as hell.
Yeah. But even like, I think every older case that we've done, I've really enjoyed researching, other than the Aid family member family murders, because I thought there was going to be a whole lot more information than there was, and I was really disappointed.
Yeah.
But we hope you like the old cases, too.
Yeah, for sure. But that being said, I think we're going to finish it off with a little bit of the Keith's Demise, which is a New England IPA, 6% ABV.
It's also considered a milkshake IPA.
A milkshake IPA.
Yes, we've had this before.
Have we? I always forget.
Okay, so a milkshake IPA is similar to the New England style IPA. It uses pectin-rich fruit or... It uses pectin-rich fruits, oats, and lactose to enrich the beer.
It smells freaking awesome. When I was pouring it, holy crap.
Well, it is their mango IPA.
Oh, that's funny. I'm not a huge mango fan, but in things, mango can be good. Cheers.
Cheers.
Oh, yeah. That's a winner. I like that a lot, too. That was really good.
Definitely an IPA. What would you give it?
I would five that one. That one's really, really good. Again, very well balanced, super smooth.
It's not overly IPA-y either.
I will say for an IPA, it's not super hoppy. So if you like a not hoppy IPA, like you're not a huge fan of like the real hoppy IPAs.
I'm not a fan of hops.
So it's this would be a really, like, this is an awesome one for you. But even it's as a person, even as a person who likes IPAs, this is very well balanced. I like it. The flavor is on point.
It's that mango boo.
You know, I don't. The mango's very subtle. Very subtle.
Yeah, it is very subtle, but you don't want. Mango is a powerful flavor.
It is.
So you don't.
You don't want to overdo it.
Yeah, you don't want it to overpower everything. And they did a very good job of giving you the flavor without saying, hello, I'm a mango.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I love this one. That's really good.
It's very good.
So, yeah. Good job, Dublin Corners. Thank you to you.
And thank you to all of our listeners.
Absolutely. Thank you for joining us yet again for another episode of Blood and Barrels.
We're still working hard for you guys.
Working hard. We got them episodes coming. And as usual, we want to ask you to follow us on all the things.
Smash that like button.
Don't smash the like button.
Gently tap the like button, question mark?
Murder the like button.
Oh, okay.
Murder the like button. We're a true crime pod. You got to murder the like button.
And we are working on the princess says smash it.
She did. She ran in here and said smash it. You're gonna murder the IPA. Or not the IPA. You're going to murder the IPA button. Smash it. Smash it.
Princess, come say it in the microphone.
Hurry, hurry, hurry. Wait, ready? Come here, closer.
Smash it!
Like perfect. She said.
Perfect. She just said smash it. I say murder it. But either way, we'd love if you guys would go out and rate and review. We're trying to build the podcast. We've been out for, God, how long have we been doing this for now?
Over a year.
Over a year.
Year and a couple months. And we have another live.
Possibly coming. We're working out all the details on that.
It's coming. We just have to work out the details.
We're working out the details. So, yeah. But we have things coming. So, yeah. We love you guys. We want to thank you for joining us yet again.
Send us recommendations.
We love it. We got some Patreon episodes coming out here pretty soon.
We do. Well, we have lots of Patreon, shockingly. And we have some Patreon recommended cases that we're going to do.
That's what I was actually talking about. Yeah. Although we do have... You've researched a ton of Patreon, so we're about to be stacking up the Patreon
here. Oh, yeah. Soon. Patreon is, we have two that are in editing mode right now.
I'm excited because we're doing, and I thought Amy was nuts when she decided to do it, but we're doing a series on Patreon, so that'll be coming out soon. It'll be actually kind of cool.
The first episode is done. Research. Just got to record it.
Yeah, we'll probably record that this week. So anyway, lots of fun and exciting things coming your way. So
merch ideas.
Oh yeah, we do have merch on the website if you want to check that out, although we need to update all of our other shit on the website.
John Douglas is my hero.
We'll work on it. We'll see how that works out. Anyway, we love you guys. We are out.
We will. Oh, I just tried
to pull you. Oh, you tried to steal my line.
What?
We will check you next time.
We love you all.
Laters. Thank you for joining us here at Blood and Barrels. You can follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Blood and Barrels. You can also follow us on Twitter at Blood Barrels Pod.
Follow us on all the things.
You can also listen to Blood and Barrels on Apple Podcast, Spotify, Google Podcast, Stitcher, or most anywhere where you enjoy your podcast.
If you enjoy listening, please head over to Apple Podcast and rate, review, and subscribe. For more information about the show, you can check us out at bloodandbarrels.com.
If you want to help support the show and become a part of the Blood and Barrels family, you can join us on Patreon and get access to additional content. Thank you, and we'll see you next time. And it's over now.
No, we got one more beer to try.
And I don't know how.
Mike's gonna
get it back to good. Matchbox 20 song I had.
Oh.
Couldn't help myself.
All right. Didn't know that is probably not the Matchbox 20 song I would have picked.